You are now listening to the Black Girl Nerds Podcast.
Five, six, seven, eight. Holla, boys and girls, it's the BGN. Coming from the Marvel world to the DC friends. All the way from Hollywood to the PCN. She defends everyone from sleazy men. Won't apologize for spitting Shonda rhymes. The space that we make is never colonized. Talking games and movies and actors.
Word? Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds. Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds. Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Black Girl Nerds Podcast. My name is Jamie and I am your host this week. We are pleased to present to you filmmaker Justin Simien. You know him best from films like Dear White People, Haunted Mansion, and Bad Hair. He is back with an incredible docuseries that is currently streaming on MGM+. Hollywood Black is the name of the docuseries, and it's inspired by the book from historian Donald Bogle. Directed and executive produced by Justin Simien, it chronicles the history of cinema, but from a radically Black perspective, by unearthing personal stories from actors, writers, directors, and producers who fought for their place on the page, behind the camera, and on the screen. The series provides a critical re-examination of quintessentially an American story, brilliant in color. So, if you are a fan of all things cinema and want to hear some incredible conversation between myself and Mr. Justin Simien, then listen, sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of the Black Girl Nerds Podcast featuring director and executive producer of Hollywood Black, Justin Simien.
How was the rest of the con for you?
It was good. It was really good. Yeah. I had some really great moments. I know you did too, hosting a panel and doing all the things.
It was fun. I actually enjoyed Comic-Con this year. I'm so surprised. I didn't overload my nervous system this time.
Was this your first time, though, hosting a panel?
Hosting a panel, heck yeah, for sure. Yeah. That was a big lift. Before it's been promotional stuff. And then when I was a publicist, I used to work Comic-Con. I used to work a booth.
I didn't know you used to be a publicist.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I was a publicist at Rogue Pictures. And so it was part of a subsidiary of Focus Features at the time. So, I remember handing out Seat of Chucky buttons and... That was my introduction to Comic-Con as an overstimulated introvert.
Well, look, I'm glad to be able to talk to you. I love the support that you give us on Instagram and how you like our posts and I really love the work that you're doing, and I love this docuseries, Black Hollywood. As a matter of fact, it felt like you had all of Black Hollywood in this docuseries.
I was very, it grew out of an extension of the kind of conversations I'm already having with my peers. And in fact, before it was a docuseries, in my mind, the most I was maybe going to do is do this as a podcast. I loved having my podcast, partly because as an introvert that is working a lot, it is hard to actually make time to talk to my friends and peers in Hollywood. And what was great about that podcast is that we would sit around with people I would want to talk to anyway, and we'd talk about these really interesting subjects. So my first thought was I'll just do this. I want to talk to my peers about the history of Black cinema. I want to discover Black movies with my friends, and I want us to reflect on how these things in the past are really super tied to actually what we're going through right now. And it just kind of snowballed and grew from there. So I was grateful that, on the other side of it, on both sides of an epic strike and during a time when all of us were on that hamster wheel, and when we had a window of opportunity to work, we had to take it, that people still were able to find times to sit with me and to sit with our crew and to get into some really important stuff. And it was awesome. It fed my soul to make this. So happy that everyone showed up.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up about talking to all of these different folks that's in this docuseries, because what was that process like? I mean, there's some incredibly noteworthy and notable people that's in this docuseries. So what was the process of getting all of those folks together?
Well, it was multi-pronged. I mean, we had an amazing team, Radical Media, the production house behind this. We had Forest Whitaker's company. We had my company, Culture Machine. Everyone just on all cylinders. Me sending texts, voice notes, emails. We had a casting department reaching out to people. If you knew someone's agent or publicist, saw them at a party, you know, it was really like all hands on deck. Because again, like, you know, there's not a lot of us out there. And when
Right.
one of us has an opportunity to work, we gotta go. We're not gonna necessarily be checking our emails every day for this sort of thing. So it was like, it really was a group and team effort. And then it was like kind of awe-inspiring because there's some people who I've known, but there's some people I never got to meet. I never got to meet, you know, Charles Burnett or Charles Lane, or Erica Alexander. These are people who like I have maybe a parasocial relationship with, but I never got to sit in front of. And to kind of really connect, and whether I was meeting them for the first time or seeing them after a long time, like that connection was there. We really we're all in that same wavelength. We all appreciate this history so much, and really relish any opportunity to kind of to unveil it and unmask it for other people. So it was a lot of love. It was just a lot of love and a lot of dedicated people.
Were there any folks that didn't make it into the docuseries that you wanted to be a part of this project?
Oh yeah, I mean, it would have been great to have been able to get Spike to sit down for us. I mean, luckily for us, Spike is a media giant, and so there's so many clips of him talking that we were able to use. But it would have been great to chop it up with him. And I think also, you know, Tyler Perry, who I think for whatever reason, you know, was busy or unavailable. I'm always kind of looking for opportunities to talk to him and to sort of show that what he does is not as separate from, you know, what some the rest of us are doing in the way that it sometimes gets portrayed. I think that there really is something unique that binds all Black artists in Hollywood. And even though we can sometimes get divided and be divisive, there is a shared struggle that we all have, and there's a shared experience that we all have. And I think that that's really important and really precious. We are still being erased from the timeline. Erasure is very real. And whether we're talking about book bans or shadow bans on social media platforms, Black voices are still extremely fragile and our platforms are very precarious. So, you know, it would have been great to get some more folks, but I'm super happy with the folks we did get and the conversations we had. Especially with the female filmmakers, you know, who don't always get the shine that they deserve.
I know, I loved seeing Gina. I love seeing Cheryl. I loved
Yes.
seeing all of, Lena in there. Like, I love seeing all of them. And you mentioned Erasure, which is a great segue into my next question. I love how this docuseries that takes us through the history of Hollywood and these race films that we saw in the past. And I went to film school and I also studied Oscar Michaud.
Yes.
Through my academia, and he was one of those filmmakers that we definitely look to, but there's so little history about him and even other filmmakers that you just don't hear about of
Yeah.
his time. And I guess my question is, do you think that that part of history will ever be unearthed? Because you do touch on that in the documentary, how that is erased and how we still don't have a lot of that history that has yet to be told. Do you think that's something that we'll eventually find? Is that something that
I
you're
sure hope
still
so.
struggling to look for?
I sure hope so. And I hope Hollywood Black is just the, because it is the tip of the iceberg. There's so much going on, especially in the race films between Oscar Michaud and was a time. And some of this was due to segregation. So I'm not saying like, you know, make America great again. We're not doing that. But there was a time when there was a time when there was an alternate Black Hollywood where we had our own stars. We had movies in absolutely every genre. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Black films, musicals, westerns, gangster movies, sci-fi, horror, etc. And you know, we've never really seen, even in the modern era with so many Black filmmakers and their, you know, Black channels and all that, I don't think we can fully comprehend what that was like. And so many of those movies were lost to time. They were not preserved. Some of them were, you know, intentionally destroyed and discarded. You know, everything about, you know, what survives is so white. But underneath those white films, underneath something like, you know, the jazz singer or the musical craze in the 30s, is Black culture. And so this is, you know, the start of something, because there's so much more to unearth. There's so many films that we have not been discovered or restored. People just haven't cared or had the resources to really investigate this stuff. So, you know, I there's gotta be more. I'm dying for it, you know. So hopefully this is just an inspiration point for someone else to dig deeper.
Indeed. One of the things that really touched me in the docuseries is you mentioned in the documentary about Diana Ross and the film Mahogany. And the first time you saw it, that was someone that operated in the energy that felt familiar to you, is what you said. What specifically about that film and Diana's role in it resonated with you?
You just never seen a woman like that with such agency and so Black and yet not bound by any social rules around what it meant to be a Black woman. I think in Mahogany, you see her, I think there's a moment in Mahogany where I believe she takes a wig off or something. And just like the admission that she was wearing one, but also that like she looks fantastic regardless of what the aesthetic around her is. She spoke to men like a man would, you know, and yet she used her femininity and her grace and her beauty. It was in her power. It never made her, you know, even though she's imperiled in that movie in a couple moments, but she always seemed to have the power and the control and the agency to use her beauty and what made her special, you know, to navigate a space that was not built for her and that was controlled by these very powerful men. And as a gay man, there's just something about that I related to before I even understood what I was relating to exactly. I think the fact that she is a female force that also has like a masculine edge made her kind of just operate in a space that kind of, you know, it just held space for me until I could see actual like gay men operating in narratives. You know, you just kind of use what you can get. And as far as divas go, you know, it's just harder to get bigger and better than Diana Ross. I mean, I'm still, you know, I didn't grow up in that era. I grew up in the 80s, but I'm still like discovering her, you know, and the places she existed, those TV specials, the live albums. It's an obsession, you know?
Yeah. That film is epic. And even just her other films of that era and that genre, ladies.
I love Mahogany and I forgive it for all its flaws, because there's just something happening in it that is not happening in other movies. And that something is Diana Ross.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Facts on top of facts. And Billy Dee, like, he just was everything in that.
Oh, my God, Billy Dee. Just never hotter. Like,
my mom was in love with some Billy Dee back in the
of
day.
Of course, I'm in love with Billy Dee. You know, it's just like,
who is it?
It just does not get hotter. I'm sorry. The two of them, it's nuts.
On top of facts. I loved the word that you used in this docuseries, the word minstrelsy. I had never heard that term used before in that way. And you mentioned that it still exists today in the Black contemporary films that we see. Do you think it's a chronic problem that we have, like it was generations ago, or has it improved?
I think minstrelsy is probably the driving force of all American popular culture. And I'm saying that in present tense, because minstrelsy, I think, looks like blackface and tap dancing and that kind of thing. But what it really is describing is this kind of like constant, like nonstop, persistent appropriation of Black culture by white people with the intention to remove Black people from, you know, any ability to capitalize off of it. So if you call it that, if that's what it is, it's white people seeing Black people do a thing, and then those white people start doing it without the Black people. It's all over the place. I mean, look at go on TikTok for 2 minutes. You will encounter countless influencers, dancers, people who are starting memes and trends who are like, we came up with this thing, and then these white influencers did it, and now they're like the highest paid influencers on the platform, and we're struggling to get deals. That is minstrelsy. Yeah. When you hear music on the radio that's R&B, but that's a white singer singing it, and so therefore it has a much bigger pop culture is, you know, pop culture is obsessed with white people that can do things that are perceived Black, but not really the other way around. That is minstrelsy in action. AI, in my opinion, is the ultimate form of minstrelsy. That is the ultimate form of being able to take the fruits of artistic labor without really having to deal with the artist that made it. And of course, it has affected Black people most profoundly because we have been at the bottom of this caste system since the country's founding, but it bubbles all the way up. Everyone is affected by it in some kind of way. I don't think America knows how to America without minstrelsy, if I'm being honest. And I think we just gotta, it's not like I'm trying to like call anyone out, or it's just like, we all have to see it. We have to all look at it and see it. It's not like a problem we can nip in the bud. It's like our way of life as a society, and it deserves like a lot more attention, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think about films like Bamboozled, which was made over 2 decades ago, and it's still, right. still it's relevant so today. Fresh. It was way ahead of its time. Bamboozled is
so fresh.
And
I think about, I think that's why Burt Williams was so important to me, because he is somebody that even Black people, we don't really learn about Burt because he was a minstrel, and you look at pictures of a Black man in blackface, you just don't want to look too much further into that story. But he was the beginning of how all Black people actually operate, myself included, where he took what he got and he found a way to be really subversive inside that space. And you go back to the things he was making in the 1900s, a play called Indahome, and it is the most fresh, radical thing I've ever seen about Black people plotting to go back to Africa in the 1900s. That is still fresh to this day, because we are still grappling with these same exact issues and topics.
Last question. There's a lot of notable people that's commenting in this docuseries. You've got directors, you've got authors, you've got film curators that are speaking on a variety of issues. Who would you say that this documentary is for?
It's for everybody. It's for film lovers, but it's for Black people first. I think this wasn't even my idea. I was one of my producers, David. It was like, I think this is like your Dear Black People. And I was like, it is, because whether we want to be or not, we are at the bottom of popular culture. We are the fuel of popular culture. And the more of us that can recognize that and realize that we are not fighting for a place inside of something, we are really just fighting to reclaim something that was already ours. If as many of us can be empowered about our role in society and be conscious about it as possible, then we'll make more films, we'll tell more stories, We'll look at things like the collapse of Hollywood as an opportunity and not just a crisis. And we have to do that. We have to be more intentional about it, because we're going to get used anyway. Our culture is going to get used to fuel this machine, whether we like it or not. We might as well be aware of it and get a piece of the action. So it is for Black creators of all kinds, first and foremost.
Well, Justin, I'm glad that we had the chance to speak. I really enjoyed this docuseries. It was entertaining. It was informative. I really hope that everyone gets a chance to see it. I feel like this is something that should be played in schools too, because it's
It's a resource, and that's all it is. It's like, this should just exist. It should like just the phone book or something. It should just exist.
Absolutely. So thank you for taking the time to speak to Black Girl Nerds.
Appreciate it. My pleasure, always. Thank you so much.
All right, you take care.
You too.
Bye.
The Black Girl Nerds podcast is produced by Jamie Broadnax. The opening theme song to our show is written and performed by Samus. Various instrumentals are performed by Samus, Sky Blue, and Shubzilla. You can find various episodes of the Black Girl Nerds podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Audioboom, Google Play Music, and Spotify.